Hello and welcome to episode 235 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. Welcome to the final show before we break up for the summer holidays. We record this as the country is basically facing Armageddon, unless you live in some bits of the country, in which case it's just a normal day. Mr. Weston, how are you surviving the heat?
Well, I think I've been doing quite well today, Matt. It's been, I was in the office this morning where there was air conditioning, and therefore I was untroubled by the heat outside. But then I came home at lunchtime and did a 25 minute drive through the countryside with the roof down, and nearly spontaneously combusted before I got home. And then actually it was quite cool in the house, relatively speaking. And even now it's quite cool when you come in and the thermometer says 28 degrees, and I'm thinking, oh, that's nice and cool. Which just shows how relative things can be. So yeah, we're coping and everything seems to be okay. The poor cat looks a bit ill, but you know, we'll pull her through. And yeah, it's been fantastic, hasn't it? And the week has. I mean, it's only been a few days since we recorded, Matt. It only seems like yesterday.
It was a bit more than yesterday, but it's not far off.
Yeah, it was last Wednesday, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
And since then, all that's been happening really is there's the political shenanigans and the Conservative Party leadership thing. I didn't watch the first debate, but I watched some of the debate yesterday on ITV. And all you could think was, my God, one of these people is going to be Prime Minister. And whilst it is something of a stretch to think that the Conservative Party could have managed to provide three Prime Ministers in the last 12 years, each one worse than the last, and then try to actually beat that with a fourth. I mean, there were chances with the people running that it could happen, right? I mean, some of the more bizarre candidates have dropped out, but you know, I'm not sure they're finished, and I think that would be a remarkable achievement.
Yes, it's a strange thing that happens, isn't it, when a government has been in power for too long. And it's easy, I suppose, partly because certainly for me, getting older, you kind of, time does seem to speed up a bit, but it's hard to believe it's now 12 years since this current thing has been in power. I think that the Conservatives, when did they, 18 years, wasn't it, when Thatcher and then Major, so they've got a way to go to be able to beat that. But it does feel like it's completely gone off the rails now. And I just, yeah, it's just how bad they are at public speaking. There isn't, you know, public speaking isn't all there is to politics, but it does help if you can clearly articulate a message once in a while. And none of them seem to be able to do that reliably.
No, they're not particularly informative or inspiring, are they? And, you know, probably the best of them is maybe little tiny fishy Sunak. And even he looks like kind of Thunderbird's marionette. Really, he's not that convincing, but he's probably still the best of them in terms of his presentation.
Yeah, I think the idea that one of them will be in power for a bit is terrifying. I find personally the idea that all of them are younger than me also terrifying, because that's another sort of staging post in getting older when the Prime Minister is younger than me.
Are they all younger than you?
Every single one of them. Every single one of them is not only younger than me, but younger than you. I think the oldest of them from memory it's either Tugendhat or Truss, and they were both born in 1973.
Wow, you know, they look older than me.
They do, yes. I suppose that you haven't had to spend your life conniving your way up to the top of the Tory party, so therefore you've kept youth on your side.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I thank God for that. That's all I can say. I'm glad. I'm not sure I've got that in me, frankly, to get to the top of any political party. It just seems like far too much caring about people's drains, or at least pretending to care about people's drains, and having to make friends with people that you'd much rather avoid at any possible moment, and that, therefore not really in my skill set, I don't think.
No, I think the ability for them to be able to then quickly show how little they like each other is the other thing, that many of these people who are currently, well, not performing on our television because they've all bunked off, realising the terrible damage it's doing to them, their reputations and the reputation of the governing party. But it, the dislike that they are now so evidently showing of each other, and particularly those who've been in cabinet together, shows you how wafer thin that pleasantry is.
Yeah, I guess that's definitely an issue. And again, why would you, even if you could fool yourself into thinking that you're friends with somebody that you're clearly not, having to walk around with some sort of rictus grin whilst you stand next to your enemy? I mean, that's even more. I couldn't do that either. So not for an extended period, at least. Maybe I could have when I was younger. I don't know.
No. More and more, I do think that the psychology of the people who want to be getting involved in party politics should bar them from being anywhere near public office.
Yeah, it's an often, you know, it's an often stated idea, isn't it, that anybody that seeks power is automatically unsuitable for it. Like, anybody who wants to wear a uniform shouldn't really have the power associated with it. And, well, I guess this is the wisdom of what is clearly now our advanced age, given that we're older than them all. And we can stand on the sidelines and throw bricks. Sounds like a, you know, perfectly reasonable and civilised way to go.
One step away from waving our fists and shouting at clouds.
I'm already there, mate.
There is that. Anyway, it is, as I said, the last show before our summer break. Well, I said Christmas break there. That would be a long gap. So we are going to have another episode this week of Ask WB40. Beautiful people who are members of the WB40 Signal Group have been coming up with questions, more probably than we will be able to answer in this episode, but we're going to take a stab at it. So let's crack on. Okay, so if you're not familiar with the Ask WB40 format, then it works like this. We get some questions in from our esteemed audience, and then we ask those questions of each other and then answer them. It's a remarkable format that has, you know, no former precedent, I'd say. So let's kick off. Your first question, Chris. How long will it be a buyer's market for people looking to move jobs in the UK?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? That I guess everybody wants to know the answer to. It really is. Well, it's a buyer's market if you are moving jobs, I guess. A seller's market if you're in the job market, and if you're a candidate. And how long will it be that? Well, in tech, I mean, this must be a, I guess I means in tech, because certainly in tech, the skills are so rare, and the push to what I suppose call digital transformation, the push to do those things, whether it's move stuff to the cloud or to change processes or all that stuff that we kind of had to do in the pandemic, and then everybody's realized that every single thing that they do now is absolutely technology focused, data focused, and the genie is completely out of the bottle and everybody wants to do everything now, please. And I don't think that's going to change for some time. We've got, you know, potentially a recession coming up. We've got stagflation potentially in the UK. But there's still lots of cash floating about, and people will spend money in order to be there at the end of the recession so that they can take advantage of an upturn. So if they've got money, they will put money into being coming out of recession strongly. And we saw there was a graph that I was using in my last months at IDC about the fact that in the 2007 recession, IT spend dropped considerably lower than the overall drop in spending and the overall drop in GDP. Whereas this time around, with the COVID, and I guess for a COVID you can understand because of the nature of the lockdowns and all of that kind of thing, but IT spend was much less impacted than previously. But again, I do think the difference between 2007 and now in the way that technology is in our businesses is like night and day, isn't it? So for me, I think it'll be challenging to find people for quite a long time, and it'll still be a seller's market if you're in tech. How the rest of the economy will work, that's another question altogether, and I'm hoping that's not what I was asked.
I think, well, on that broader economy thing, though, we drove past Heathrow Airport, or through the back of Heathrow Airport at the weekend, and notable that signs up at Swissport, one of the big handling agents, big signs up outside saying hiring now. And of course, at the core of the challenges that Heathrow and Gatwick in particular have got at the moment is not enough ground crew doing things like luggage handling and so on. And I think that there is a, you've got a number of forces happening there, which are a smaller workforce potentially because of what happened after 2016 and people leaving the UK to go back to Europe, and a challenge of an ageing workforce. And one of the things that has been noticeable, some commentary out the back of the pandemic, is people who were getting closer to retirement age just deciding that their life is too short and it's just time to stop working now. And those two things, I think we could well find that there's continuing seller's market for highly sought after skills and a continuing seller's market for kind of manual labour skills. And the bit that's going to be interesting is the hollowing out of the sort of medium level management in the middle and the stuff that will be susceptible to automation. And I'm not a big advocate of the idea that everything can be automated and that jobs disappear as a result, jobs change. But I think it's going to be interesting to see that we could end up with large levels of underemployment or gaps with people not being able to be filled at either end of the economy, and then a lot more pressure for stuff in the middle as well. So we will see. Certainly though, at the moment, I mean, for what we're looking at, data skills really, really hard to come by. DevOps skills really hard to come by. We've got, you know, a lot of work going on to bringing the right people into the right pieces of work on those kind of areas. So there's, yeah.
How much are you paying, Matt? I know what Jenkins is. And I know what DevOps is. How much is it?
We've got a very extensive recruitment process that I'm not sure you'd get through.
Okay, right. Well, on that rather dispiriting note, let's move on to the next question before we run out of time. So we've got another question. So Matt, put these things in order of importance. Salary, who your boss is, what the purpose of the organisation is, and what your day-to-day work is.
That's an interesting one, having recently been thinking about this quite a bit. I think it goes something like the purpose, the day-to-day work, the boss, the salary. But I am in a position where I am of great privilege because I'm relatively wealthy and I've got reasonable skills that seem to be reasonably in demand, so I can afford to have it that way round. The interesting bit, though, is that who my boss is, as I've spoken a bit about on the show before, the organisation in which I now work doesn't have bosses. And so it matters to me, but the autonomy bit is probably missing from that question. But the ability to have autonomy about what it is that I do is probably more important than most of those, apart from purpose.
You see, I think I would say that salary is the most important, and I don't say it because it's the thing that motivates anybody, but I do think unless that's sufficient to meet your requirements, you know, that you've kind of set out in your life, then it's not, everything else is really a luxury, right? So even if the job I do now was paying half as much as it does, it wouldn't matter that I think the purpose of the company is good. It wouldn't matter that my day-to-day work is interesting or that I've got a really good boss. All of that sort of stuff would be kind of, yeah, fine, but it wouldn't pay enough. And that's, I do think salary has got, for me, it's got to be the most important because it's the one you cannot possibly do without. Now, when you get to the point, if your boss happens to be some sort of sociopathic idiot, or your day-to-day work is drudge, or it's frustrating, or the purpose isn't really aligned, then you probably end up leaving. But I don't think, and maybe if you realise that before you go, maybe you don't take the job. But I think those are a lot more, you know, you can change them a little bit. You can check, you can, if you're, you know, I'm one of those people who thinks, oh, I'll sort this lot out, even if it looks a bit toxic. I'll sort it out. And I've been in a situation where I thought I was going to do that and I haven't, right? So, but what I'm saying is that people do, you know, they back themselves sometimes to rise to challenges, whereas, you know, it's kind of you've got to put food on the table, right? And you've got to pay your mortgage. So for me, I would say salary is the most important, but only because of that. And after that, probably, it's very hard to say, isn't it? Because the purpose is really important. I think day-to-day work is probably the next most important, because it's probably the next thing that's going to push you out of it, and then boss, and then purpose. But you know, they're all important, right? And like you, I'm in a job now where I'm lucky that the purpose, I know that the purpose behind the business is a sound one, and I am in a position to affect that now. And you know, the boss is the person that owns the business, and I've known them for a long time. And my job is not to need a boss in that sense. My job is to grow that business, and my day-to-day work is pretty much what I decide it's going to be. But you know, other, as well as the being dragged into, you know, this, that, and the other, which is, you know, part of the course. So yeah, I guess it's very easy for us to sit here and say, well, this question is a bit moot, but in certain, when one of them is really hurting you, then it really is hurting you.
So I get that. Out of interest, though, why don't you work in finance? Because you could have much more salary if you did that.
Well, I guess so. It's because I guess, and this might come on to a later question, but I went into IT because it was probably the easiest thing for me to do, because I had an aptitude for it. And if I was to go into finance at any stage in my career, that would have needed me to do some work in order to retrain.
If you go into finance to work in IT, you'd get paid way more than you would in any of the sectors that you've worked.
What? I might do that. No, that's true. Absolutely true. And I know that there are people, yeah, absolutely, they earn a lot in finance. I guess you're right. There are certain, it's almost where you work, right? Because I've worked in London a fair bit, and I don't mind going there every now and again. But really, in most cases, if you want to work in finance and get paid a lot, you have to go and work in London, you know, 5 days a week, and that's just not something I've ever wanted to do. So maybe where you work is one of those things that would be in that.
Yeah, that's interesting. So another question that's kind of in this sort of area as well: what career-related ambitions do you have left?
Well, that comes down to that first part, right? So I'm wondering, I'm thinking back to when I started out in my world of work, how many careers and ambitions I had then. So to ask how many I have left is rather... so I guess one gathers ambitions as one goes along, and to think, okay, I could do this and I could do that. And I don't know really, because I've never really enjoyed doing the same job twice. So once I've done a thing, I'm normally finished with it, and I don't want to do that again. And now, I guess the one thing I haven't done is really be involved. No, I mean, but be involved in growing a business in technology, which is, and it's what I want to do now. So I've sort of been involved in growing a business before, but it was very much as a kind of, and I was on the board, but I was very much in the kind of in the mix, in the middle of it, in IT and, you know, and related things. Whereas now, being a bit more experienced, and you do different things as you're older, different things with more experience and a bigger network. So I think I want to do this, and I want to grow this business to the satisfaction of the owner and of the shareholders and of the people in it, so that, you know, the people in it can grow. I mean, there are people in it, for example, who could certainly going to go a long way in their careers. They've got more they can do, and if they can do it at Jumar because we've grown it and we've built that structure that allows them to do that, then that's great for me. So that's probably it, really. And I don't really have any. I think they come along as I'm starting to think that the current one is wearing out, right? So I don't think I have any more. What about you?
So, in terms of roles, I kind of stopped doing it on the basis of roles when I became a CIO when I was 39, because I'd set myself the target of becoming a CIO by 40 and kind of just vaguely overachieved. And what I then realised was that the idea of just saying my next career ambition or goal is to do the next role of X becomes a bit tedious. I mean, it's fairly tedious that way around anyway, but as you get older and you get more experience, just about role by role, And a bit like you, I didn't like the idea of just doing the same job again in a slightly bigger organisation or having to step down a level or two to be able to build myself up to doing the same role again in a much, much bigger organisation. So that's when the whole stamp thing came about, which was, although it became the name of the business that I operate occasionally under and did for 6 years full time, it's a career aspiration basically, and it's about being able to do things that have some sort of social importance and social meaning. I don't know what those are, but I make decisions about what I do next based on how much is this likely to be able to help me do that, achieve some stampable things. So there's some work I'm doing with the Criminal Justice Service at the moment that might have that kind of impact. There's some work that I'm doing with a charity that does stuff around dance. That's a bit on hold at the moment because Elizabeth is having a baby soon, but that again is something that might do that. So I just kind of spread my bets a bit about being able to try to be able to identify ways in which I can do something that ends up being something of meaning, really. And I'll probably continue to do that right until I pop my clogs, to be honest.
Well, that sounds reasonable. Let's hope it's a few years yet. Another 200 episodes at least. Right, okay, we've got another question here. And this, how do you think about this one, Matt? With the cost of living and rising skills gap, what can organisations or what should government be doing to get more young people and career switchers the skills they need? And the person who asked the question says that apprenticeships are a start, but the name is often misunderstood, particularly by the older demographic.
The idea of the skills gap is, I think, really interesting and a real challenge, and probably one of the reasons why we have productivity issues in the UK. I think it starts by really thinking about how we provide people at all ages with the skills that they need to be curious and to learn new things. And I'm not sure that there are enough people still who come out. And in fact, education, I think, got better in this for a while, but I've got a feeling now with the very syllabus-based look at facts and figures and rote learning and, you know, the nth degree of understanding of grammar, I'm not sure that we're teaching curiosity in kids that much. I certainly don't see it that much in my two, as much as I try to be able to inspire it outside of school. And that's the bit, I think. And I don't know how that happens, and I don't know what the answer to that is, but if you can find people and nurture their curiosity to want to be able to find things out and do things and explore different worlds, that for me is the core here. It's about how do we get people not thinking that a career path is a one-dimensional straight line, who can be accepting of the fact that the jobs that you'll do next might have not existed when you started working, can be able to be adaptable to being able to not be fearful of not necessarily feeling that they are completely competent in what they do. Because with new things, you're always going to have to go through that learning bit where it's really scary. So for me, I think that that's at the core. If I could make a single change to the way in which we think about providing the skills that people need to be able to work effectively, it would be, how do you make them more curious? And then being able to act upon that.
I think that's true. So learn how to learn is one of the things that Tony Harper, who's been on the podcast a couple of times, who regular listener, Tony, and who runs an apprenticeship company, right? So he's somebody who's been very much involved in this for several years now. And he will say that one of the reasons he did that was because he was hiring people when he worked for a big SI, and he was always appalled, especially at the grads, how little they knew and how utterly unprepared they were for work. So he saw apprenticeships as a way to help fix that, and that's the way his career went. So when the apprentice idea first took off, I was in a big organisation. I wasn't really in the place where I could affect their policy on apprentices. But as soon as I then got into a role where I was back into a kind of CIO, CTO role, I took apprentices on because I thought it was incumbent on organisations to make the move to grow their own talent and not just keep fishing in the same pond as everybody else. And that was pretty successful in many ways. And those apprentices, I know that I still see one or two of them doing well in their careers. And that for me was worthwhile, very much, very worthwhile. And for a while, I did a little bit of mentoring with apprentices in Tony's business. And again, that was very worthwhile. On LinkedIn, I'll see sometimes I'll be doing this or that, and it's nice to see. And actually, I do think apprenticeships will continue to grow in popularity. The name is a little bit, you know, engineering and woodwork and all that sort of thing, but I think that will probably move. I think things will move on. Not least because if you want to learn and get a degree and be useful, you've got a far better chance of that with an apprenticeship than a university degree course, frankly, because you'll still get the interaction. You'll still be mixing with people in your own age, but you'll get paid and you won't leave with a whole bunch of debt and you'll have experience. So I think apprenticeships are a good thing. I also think that the career switch stuff, getting graduates to think outside of their degree, you know, even when they're not like, you know, Cambridge first with a, you know, they're going to the graduate schemes and the civil service fast track or whatever, even if that exists at that point, or in the graduate schemes where they're encouraged to sort of go and try different things. I think we did a graduate day at GMI the other day, you know, and we're not a massive company, but we can afford to invest in some graduates. But we're still kind of looking for STEM skills and coding skills, because that's the fastest way to get somebody into our business. But we're also now looking at how we get people who are maybe left university and have a degree, maybe in a STEM subject, but maybe not. And I think, well, what am I going to do with this now? You know, I'm working at McDonald's and I've got a chemistry degree. What am I going to do with it? So that sort of thing I think is really important. And I think we also need to think about almost micro jobs, in as much as there are people now who can't come into the office and never could, but because we're all working remotely, could do a couple of hours a day. Now, what can you do with a couple of hours a day? And it's quite hard to imagine that, but that's because of the way we've always worked. And I suspect there are ways that we can chunk jobs down, and we can share them around, and that if you are creative and imaginative and a good manager and leader, you can have a team of people who have only got a few hours here and there, who are looking after children or whatever, and can do between, you know, 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the evening, 3 days a week or something like that. I really think there are ways to bring those people into the economy, but it needs some thinking about in a way that I haven't really done. What do you think?
Well, I guess, yeah, on that last point, you also have to be able to think about how we retrain managers so that they're able to be able to cope with the increasing flexibility that is required for the workforce to operate. And there's an awful lot of people who weren't very good managers before are now faced with the idea of hybrid working, multiple location working, flexible working in terms of compressed hours, in terms of shorter working weeks, in terms of job shares. It's just too much for them. They weren't very good when it was 9 to 5 and everybody was just in front of them and they could shout at them. They're now just floundering.
Yeah.
So there's something about how do we bring a new set of skills for people who are not necessarily in managerial roles but are in leadership positions within organisations to help foster and nurture people wanting to be able to do things differently. And getting over that thing, you know, one of the hardest things I think often is if you've got somebody good in your team, you fight tooth and nails to keep them in your team. And that's often just the wrong thing because they need to go somewhere else. And finding people who can also be empathetic to the needs of the individual so that they can allow them to be able to find what they do next.
Oh, yeah, but that's about incentivization, isn't it? How do you incentivize people to let people go rather than hang on to them and all of that kind of thing?
Yeah, so... So in this, it's all quite people-y this time around, which is good. So another question then, can HR be dispensed with as we move away from pretending to have control and more move towards models of trust?
Oh, well, I mean, I think we've talked about that a few times over the years on this podcast, Matt. And the question, I think David D'Souza was on, didn't we? And we were asking the question about what was HR, what's the value of HR? And I think the fact is, it's a bit like the FD and the people in those departments. Those are in roles that have some regulation and legal status. And that's probably a good thing, in as much as employers have got legal responsibilities for their employees. And HR is there as much to keep you out of court as to look after the people. And so I guess from that point of view, you've got a duty of care. You can say, oh, we trust you, but you can't allow people, you shouldn't allow people through negligence to put themselves in a situation where they imperil themselves and the people they work with and for. So I think that's a fair question. And maybe we've just got a new person, a new people director. We haven't got an HR director, we've got a people director. And maybe thinking about that in a slightly different way, and what is the role for, and what is it trying to achieve? Maybe that's sort of part of the way there. But I think part of this issue is that the sort of legal side of it is going to sort of nailed some things to the ground that we can't get too far away from.
I think, there's, again, with the organisation I'm now working for, that's as close as I think, well, certainly I've ever experienced to a trust-based organisation. One of the central tenets of it all, and that's why there isn't a management hierarchy and what have you. We don't have an HR department, but there are still functions that would be familiar to anybody in an HR department. And there's a bunch of that kind of, it's not really sort of a governance function, it's just mechanical things like, making sure people are on payroll and being able to make sure that people understand, the access to various benefits that they have, and to be able to make sure that there's just the mechanics of it ticking over of what it is to be able to employ people. And it's not necessarily a duty of care, although there's elements of that that probably sits in different roles within Equal Experts. But there's just you have some stuff that has to happen for somebody to be employed. So you have to have people to be able to do that. The other thing that our people-focused people spend an awful lot of time doing now is recruitment. And we have a big operation for both being able to bring full-time staff in to roles and also bringing associates into our network for being able to work on projects. And that's a big part of our, certainly in the UK, it's a big part of our employed function. So can you get rid of an HR department? Yes. Are you going to be able to get rid of all the things that HR used to do? Probably not.
So here's another question, Matt, and it's aimed at both of us, given that we've both started new roles recently. And the question is, what have been the interesting things that our new orgs are amazing at? What has been most refreshing, and what has your experience brought to your short time there?
I think that the way in which the organisation I'm now in trusts its people to be able to just get on with stuff is quite special. And I am both really enjoying it, and I'm also slightly unsettled by it, because so many of one's assumptions about what it is to be employed, particularly having coming out of an organisation which was very hierarchical, because the sector that I came from was very hierarchical. It's brilliant, but it's also quite disorientating. It's like the floor has been removed, and it's like I'm floating, but I'm not sure what's holding me up, what's going on here. So that's been really great. I think in terms of what has my experience brought to my short time there so far, I think that because I have spent reasonably significant parts of my working life both client side and working for suppliers, and understand some of the challenges that both sides face, and being able to just get into the mind a little bit of what's going on the other side. So, for example, we've got a bit of pre-briefing of a potential client today. And one of the things that came out for me today was that it was as much about a challenge of a business operating model and internal charging mechanisms that the client is facing as it was anything to do with the technology. And we might be able to help them with that. But it isn't just here's some technology that will solve your problem, because actually the way in which they're trying to be able to shift is something that requires them to think about how do they bring people outside of the technology community on board with a very different way of thinking about how technology is delivered in the business. And being able to spot that early and be able to understand some of the challenges about, OPEX versus CAPEX budgeting, and how that can constrain how you think if you think you're trying to think in a more agile way, that kind of stuff. I hope I'm starting to bring some sort of value to it relatively early on, but it is still quite early days. How about you?
I'll tell you one of the things that I was, what I think we're amazing at. One of the things that I think I've been really pleasantly surprised about is how well how well this company has hired in the last few years, and some of the people that have come into the team and some of the people who have recently joined, exclude myself as, you know, everybody's allowed mistake, but I, you know, some of the people that are really, really quite smart and culturally they fit, right? And it's very easy to rush into these things and go, okay, this person's got all the skills and whatever, but they've really got to culturally fit. And I would say that that's been really quite exciting for me, because I can see there's the team building, which is genuinely, you know, he's got a lot of potential and wants to achieve. And that doesn't always happen, right? In fact, it's quite rare the organisation to hire well. And I would say that that's something that this business has done very well recently and is good at, amazing at, maybe because of the quality of the people that I started working with. And I think also the thing about where I'm working at the moment, they're also very, very good at looking after people. And I think, again, that's why you need to hire people with the right culture, because they really will look after people and give them chance, time and space to learn and to make sure that they're progressing in their career, whether it be on the recruitment business or in the technology business. So again, I think from a kind of humanitarian side, that is what the business does really well. I would say in terms of my experience, it always surprises me, because of course we go through our careers and we gather certain amounts of experience and certain amount of knowledge, some of which expires because it's technological probably and it's out of date, and some of it you have to keep you on top of that stuff. But probably what I've been able to bring in this short time is just a level of, you know, outside pair of eyes at a senior level to say, actually, why are we doing that and what does that mean, and to be a kind of a fresh view on things where we've got people, you know, peers of mine who have been there a while, have been working absolutely, you know, working like stink to grow the business and done a damn good job. But of course when you're doing that, your chances to look up get smaller and smaller, right? So I think I've been able to do that, and the result of that has been quite pleasing in that you can see the lights go on a little bit, and that's always pleasing to me.
So that was a set of the questions. We've now got some more, but we're going to do this in a more quick-fire manner to be able to see if we can get through the majority of them. So here we go. Chris, your first one in the quick-fire round. As a result of the remote revolution, will we see more roles being provided by outsourcers in the future?
More, maybe. Different types of roles in a different way, probably.
I think that they're not connected, personally. I think that we might see more outsourcers in the future. We might not. I don't think that's related to remote working.
Okay. So, are you enjoying, Matt, your home office balance? And if not,
I am for the most part. If I could change anything, it would be something with a little bit more ventilation. But I think that might just be a passing phase over the next few days. How about you?
Yeah, fine for me right now. And I'm still settling into this role. And I've been in the office, or not in the office, but I've been internal for a while. I need to get back out into the world, but that's, you know, it's normal. I need to learn about the organisation before I do that. So
excellent. Do you regret some of your choices in the World Cup of biscuits?
I do not, and I'm still quite bitter that Rich Tea wasn't even on the list.
No, and Carl's water biscuit is still a biscuit.
Okay, as organisations are navigating through flex work and post-pandemic working practices, what's next, Matt?
I think we've got quite a long while to be able to work through those things. I don't know what comes next after that. All this stuff about metaverse and whatever is the latest load of tech hype. We might see some stuff coming out of the metaverse work at the moment in about 7 or 8 years' time. I don't think everybody's going to be wearing a VR helmet on their face.
No, I'll go back to my previous thing of micro work. That's my point.
Very good. What's the one thing that you think is missing from typical lists of top things CIOs need to focus on in 2023?
Wow, that's a tough one. And I don't think I've actually read that one before. I missed that one. And that probably should be my specialist subject, shouldn't it, given that I spent the last 3 years doing CIO advisor. I think it's always in there, but I don't think it's always that well articulated. And it's what's the point of what you do, and what's the point of a technology function, a centralized technology function in this day and age?
I think that there's still a gap in terms of the people stuff, and it continues to be, why don't your projects deliver because of the people stuff? Right, top 10 things you need to know, none of them are people. So that would be my call.
So we've got one more here. If you had a law named after you, as in Goodhart's Law or Conway's Law, what would it be, Matt?
Law. I think that's fairly straightforward.
Yeah, mine would be Western.
I think that's probably not the spirit of the question. I think it would probably be something about how the ability for people to defer decisions to, oh no, we'll solve it with a piece of technology, always wins out over people actually tackling the hard issues around people.
Yeah. I think trying to come up with one of the things that I've said over the years, I would still say that it's one of my laws of procurement, and it's that if you think a fool and his money are soon parted, you just watch a fool and somebody else's money.
Okay, next up we have, what IT system most changed your work world?
Wow. I mean, the database, right? For me, the database and the being able to collect data in a more distributed way, right? So say, right, I've got a database here and I've got some tables, and I can put a computer on your desk and you can put information in, and I can give you a PDA and you can put information in and you can get information out. And then shackling databases to web pages. So, you know, like with a kind of server-side PHP style, you know, those things have been really fundamental to everything I've done, really.
For me, thinking back on it, probably the Palm Pilot, which in the mid-90s was the first time that I was able to take things like my diary electronically around with me. I'm not sure it was necessarily a good thing, but that was a sort of little sign of the inevitability of what was to come with smartphones and everything else that has come since.
So, two medium-sized screens or one massive one?
I'm looking at the 28-inch monitor in front of me at the moment, one massive one. I can't, there's something for me, I really struggle with two screens. I've never been able to get it to work for me, but I'm much happier with a big screen, because essentially I've got the same, it's a high resolution screen, so I've got the same real estate as if I had two smaller screens.
Yeah, I mean, so I have got two screens. I've got, I think, 24-inch screens. No, not quite 28, so something like that. And I like that. I think maybe Steve's talking about one of those sort of strange curved ones that you see in posh people's desks. I'm not sure I can cope with that. I don't know why, but it seems to me that it's the discrete, having two discrete screens is a bit more, I don't know, maybe I've never tried it because I've never been able to afford to buy one. Maybe somebody could send me one. Maybe if Curry's are listening, send me a big screen and I'll take it.
There we go. Right, well, that's the end of the questions. Just a quick thanks to Cy Cormore, Andrew Doran, Lisa Remers, Dom Mason, Tom Geraghty, and Steve. What is Steve's surname? I never know him as Steve R. Robson, that's it. Steve Robson. For all the questions. Thanks also to Dave. We didn't get to yours, but it was a bit big. And we will be doing this at some point again in the autumn, no doubt.
So we don't have a week ahead because this is the last WB40 before we all go away on holiday, Matt. So what have you got left to get accomplished before you do disappear on holes?
So there are some pitches that are in preparation at the moment. There's a few making sure they've got the right people in the right teams, things going on. There's some work I've been doing around data and data design that I'm trying to be able to do a bit more work on before I go off on holes. And this week is also the last week I will be the parent of primary school aged children, so emotionally I need to be able to get my head around Milo finishing up at primary school, which is quite a big step, and the end of about 8 years of us being involved with the infants and junior school, which they're currently at. So yes, there's all that to do, and then there's going to be a bit of a break, which would be nice. How about you?
Well, it's a little while before I go away, so we're not going away until the end of August or the second half of August. So I've got quite a lot going on. And as I said, quite a lot of it now is about more getting out and about, figuring out how I best engage with some of our clients and prospects and network, etc. But I have to say, I've really enjoyed this last week, and I'm going to enjoy the coming weeks too. It's all good fun.
Excellent. That sounds good. Well, that's it for a month or so. We will be back, I think, on the 5th of September. We've got a couple of guests lined up already, so hopefully all that will come to pass. And continuing our ever curious exploration of what it is to be able to manage technology in 2022 and beyond. So with that, have a great summer, and we'll see you in September.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can catch us on Twitter at WB40podcast, on the internet at WB40podcast.com, and everywhere really that you get your podcast goodness. If anybody would like to send me a video of themselves running naked down their road shouting, "Listen to WB40, I will send them £10.